might as well get started. So
all good things must come to an end, and this is the last in our distinguished lecture series on emergence. And of course, we saved the best for last. So we have Dr. Robert Hazen of the Carnegie Institution of Washington Geophysical Lab. And let me tell you a few things about Bob. So he started off as a mineralogist in the 1970s. That was an exciting time for mineralogy, and I'll just point out why, because I think it indicates a lot of things. It was shortly after the perfection of the automated single crystal diffractometer, which did two things to the mineralogy community. One, it turned determining a crystal structure from a PhD thesis to a relatively short project so that you could use what you determined to really understand something instead of get stuck in the determination. Two, a lot of people who could not make that transition were very resentful of the new technology and the new people. And I bring this up because I think this happens in science all the time. And, of course, Bob was one of the people who took advantage of the new technology and invented the field of what, at that time, we called comparative crystal chemistry, where you look at crystal structures as a function of composition, temperature, pressure, whatever else you think is important, and because you can determine those structures fairly conveniently, you can look for systematics, you can look for trends, you can create a lot of data. Those are themes, I think, that have characterized him ever since, and we've all moved on since the 1970s. And Bob has moved into many things. He's a Renaissance man. He's a writer of serious science, of popular science, of fiction. He's a concert-quality trumpet player. He's engaged in teaching large undergraduate classes at George Mason University. And he's now leading a big project called the Deep Carbon Observatory, a Sloan Foundation project, which is sort of a seed for hopefully much larger things. And we talked a lot about what he should talk about, and we sort of emailed back and forth, and he could talk for 5 hours, but you probably don't want that, especially those of you that have to attend my 8:30 class tomorrow. So we finally selected a topic which really highlights emergence, and perhaps highlights emergence in what finally is perhaps the most definitive thing, at least from our selfish point of view on Earth, namely the emergence of life on Earth. Bob Hazen.
Thank you, Alex, and it's such a pleasure to be here to talk about this subject, which I really feel very passionately about. The question of the origin of life is one which has not just deep scientific implications, but deep philosophical implications as well. Indeed, there's probably no subject in which the conflict between science and religion is more clearly etched than in this question of the origin and the evolution of life. And so I want to start off by stepping back from emergence and thinking more about the ways that you can think about the origin of life. And I think there are four different possibilities for thinking about emergence. One is that life was a miracle. God created life. And, you know, for many people, that first chapter of Genesis, God created the heavens and the earth. God created plants and animals. God created us in his own image. That's sufficient. But scientists want to know more. If the origin of life was a divine creative act, a miracle, something by definition outside natural law, then it's beyond science. Science cannot address a miracle by definition because it does not conform to natural law. There are other possibilities. The origin of life could be something that's completely consistent with chemistry and physics, and yet so improbable, so rare, that in a universe of 100 billion galaxies, each with 100 billion stars, and many of those stars having multiple planets, Earth-like planets in many cases, that perhaps life only arose a few times, maybe only once. And if that's true, then again, science is really at a loss to discover in any detailed way how it happened, because if it took a trillion planets, billions of years, then a graduate student's not going to be able to do it in 1 4-year thesis. Even if we have some good chemical hints, it's going to be very difficult. Then, of course, there's the philosophical stand that anyone who does origin of life research takes. And this really is this interesting. This is one field of science that if you decide you're going to go into this field, you better believe that this is true. And that's belief. This is not truth. It's just a philosophical stand that the universe is pregnant with life, that life arises through an emergent process. And therefore, studying in a laboratory has some reasonable chance of gaining insight into how the process happened. I can't prove it. It's just a hunch. But, you know, that this is something that just happens. Okay. And if you accept that as your hypothesis, then you can imagine an approach to the origin of life that involves doing chemistry, that involves doing benchtop science, studying step by step. The key here, then, is that life began as a series of emergent steps of increasing complexity, going from a geochemical world, a non-living world, to a biological world. Okay, so that's the point of view that most scientists who work in this have. And, of course, there is also this fourth possibility, which you can argue philosophically whether it isn't folded into some of the earlier ones, but this idea of intelligent design. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up is I'm sure that this audience does not need to be convinced, but I lecture around the country, around the world even, about this subject, and this is a very clear place where people are questioning the validity of science. So what's intelligent design? It basically says that life is irreducibly complex. It's intuitively obvious, people say, that if you're walking along and you look down on the path and you see a watch and you pick it up, you look at it, you say, you know that there had to be an engineer. You may not know who the designer was, but this is vastly too complex, the intricacy of the parts intertwined and working, the materials, the workmanship. And this isn't something that just arose spontaneously. This was engineered. That's intelligent design. They say, by the same token, as simple as single cell is vastly more complex than a wristwatch. And therefore, looking at it, it's intuitively obvious there had to be an intelligent design, natural, supernatural process, something we can't know. And so this requires you to accept a combination of both some physical and chemical process that the design used, but also some supernatural or beyond knowing, something extra scientific, pseudoscientific, if you will, type approach. And so we come to this question, is intelligent design science? The proponents, of course, argue that it is. And in one very narrow sense, it passes one of the litmus tests of science. And we think we need to accept this. It does make testable predictions, testable hypotheses. They say there's absolutely no natural process by which an eye could evolve from a non-seeing organism. And you can test that. There's no process by which the bacterial flagellum could have evolved. There's no process by which the first single cell could have arisen. And if you think about it, then those, if we can go into a laboratory environment and show step by step a project of emergent complexity by which you go from simplicity to complexity, from no eye to an eye, or from no flagellum to a flagellum, if you can show that can be done, then you've disproved a prediction of intelligent design. So it is falsifiable in that sense. However, it's still fails the litmus test of science that there's this untestable, unseen designer that's lurking in there, and whether they want to claim it's God or not, that's a separate issue altogether. So intelligent design is difficult. What are we to do as scientists when faced with this? Some people argue we should teach intelligent design, teach Darwinian evolution, and let the children decide, as if these are two equally weighted things. And then the scientists say, no, we can't do that. And individuals and societies all around the world, they constantly are coming up with these statements, which makes us actually look bad. It makes us look like we're closed-minded, like somehow we're afraid of this debate. And I would argue, yes, every educated person in this country should understand this debate, but it shouldn't be taught in a science class. It should be taught in comparative religion or in current events or philosophy, something like that. But it really is a problem for science when you have, there it is, yeah, this kind of statement from the American Chemical Society and everybody else. So what are we to do as scientists? How do we approach this? Well, my point of view is that you have to design a research program. And that research program has to demonstrate a transition from a non-living to a living world. And if you can do that step by step, if you can basically show that there's a series of steps that go from simplicity to complexity systematically, then you have disproved that tenet of intelligent design. You've shown that there's a simple natural process.
Now, you still could argue on the other side of this point of view, and you may recall that there are a number of people who have said, for example, that Stonehenge was built by space aliens, that they came in with their flying saucers and they picked up the large stones and set them into place. And the sad thing, I mean, no scientist, no anthropologist can disprove that hypothesis. That is a hypothesis that is basically unfalsifiable at this stage. But what we can do, what we certainly can do is demonstrate a much simpler process by which a primitive 100,000 able-bodied people who had rope and had wood and had stone tools and had time and had an organized society and the will to do things like this, as humans have always had the will to do things like this, could have built it with all technologies that we understand and know. And so using Occam's razor, using this principle that scientists must rely on, that you take the simplest possible explanation of phenomena, you have the minimum number of extraordinary assumptions, then this has to be accepted as the true way that Stonehenge was built. And we can falsify, again, the idea that there were intelligent designers associated with Stonehenge. Okay, so my outline tonight is to kind of take it as an assumption that there is a natural process by which you can go from geochemical simplicity to biological complexity. And the process is called emergent complexity. I want to look in detail what emergent complexity is and then apply it to the emergence of biomolecules, the first step in the origin of life, then the emergence of organized molecular systems, and a key step in the origin of life, then the emergence of self-replicating systems, and finally, the emergence of natural selection, which follows logically from number four here. So this is the outline of tonight's lecture. Let's look at this thing, emergent complexity. There's so many definitions of emergence. We had a wonderful dinner this evening. We were talking about this, and we really didn't agree, but we all said, yeah, we're sort of talking about the same thing. Well, as far as I'm concerned, all emergent phenomena arise from the interaction of many different agents. They can be physical particles. They can be some other aspect of a system which can assume combinatorically huge numbers of possible configurations. And then you pass energy across that system, and what occurs then is some kind of patterning or behavior or some kind of interesting property which is selected for by the fact that you have energy interacting with those particles. So ripples, sand dunes, the various kinds of braiding that you see in stream beds, these are all examples of emergence. At a much larger scale of stars, you see this too. And what you'll see is common to these systems is that in each system, there are individual objects which are responding to the local force environment. A sand grain only experiences a few contact forces with adjacent grains, plus the wind or the water that passes across it. In the case of stars, the spiral arms arise simply by the local gravitational attraction, the fields of each star, and yet you see these larger patterns emerging. And in a rather more complex case, but still intrinsically the same, consciousness arises from the interactions of neurons, each neuron only in contact, in this case, with potentially thousands of others, with variable interactions of those, but still. Each neuron is just experiencing a local environment, and yet the collective property, the emergent property of consciousness, is something that goes beyond what any one neuron experiences. This is the character of emergence. One of my favorite examples is slime mold, Dictyostelium, a social amoeba. This organism lives most of its life as a single isolated cell. You can see the nucleus. This is a eukaryotic cell. But under certain circumstances, when the temperature, the humidity, or the nutrients in the forest floor reach a certain value, these individual cells will send out chemical signals. And those chemical signals are then causing responses by adjacent cells. They begin to come together, to coalesce. They form a slug-like organism that actually can crawl across the forest floor. Remember, these are amoebas. These are single-celled organisms that are acting cooperatively. And then ultimately what happens is you get a patterning. And that patterning results in these stalk-like structures. New cells, spores are released from the tops of the stalks. They go spreading out in the forest. And then these things melt back into the forest floor, and they become single-celled organisms again. an amazing behavior, collective behavior, an emergent behavior, which results from the individual objects responding to their local environment. You can think of our own bodies, in a sense, as that kind of emergent phenomenon. Not only our consciousness, but the whole body, we're a collection of single cells that interact in this way. And so we see this in so many different kind of behaviors. The consciousness, again, this idea of an individual nerve cell that has many dendrites. You have a neural connection. You have these electrical impulses which cause this collective phenomenon, and that's consciousness. So you can mention thousands of examples of this. They're all around us all the time. It's a part of our natural world, and it must have been part of the origin of life. We see it at so many scales, in astronomy at the scale of planets. We see it at the scale of stars, exploding stars. We see it at the scale of galaxies. And, of course, in biology, we see it at scales of molecules, for example, in cell membranes. We see it at the scale of cells. We see it also at the scale of organisms and their social behavior. I think it's astonishing. This is a photograph of ants tending aphids. Now, how in the world can that be? How can ants? Each ant is only responding to local signals. By the way, it used to be thought it was only chemical signals, but recent studies have shown that ants also emit little very high-pitched squeaky sounds, so that there's a kind of oral communication as well. But whatever it is, each ant is only responding to its local environment, and yet there are these amazing collective behaviors. That's emergence. Okay, so central assumptions about origin of life research. And you have to make some of these, just as an experimentalist, you have to make your system simple. Of course, the first one is that life is carbon-based, and you don't have to do any exotic chemistry. We're not talking about silicon chemistry, as much as silicon chemistry is very interesting, but we're really looking at carbon-based chemistry, organic chemistry of a classical kind. We also think that life's a chemical process that used the raw materials of an early Earth, a planet with oceans, atmosphere, rocks, and minerals. Nothing exotic there. And finally, there's a series of emergent steps. Now, what do I mean by emergent steps? Well, basically, I think you can reduce the origin of life to four main kinds of emergent steps. And this is really the heart and soul of my talk tonight. The first is you have to make the basic building blocks of life, the biomolecules, the amino acids which make proteins, the sugars that make carbohydrates, the lipid molecules that make cell membranes, the building blocks of DNA and RNA. That's fundamental. You have to have those, and so there has to be a process to make those. Next, you have to organize them into the larger structures, the membranes, the polymers that are so fundamental to the functioning of life. The third step is organizing into self-replicating systems, collection of molecules that actually make copies of themselves. And once you have molecules that make copies of themselves, then the natural selection follows inevitably. That's just something we'll see how that works through the course of the evening. So the idea here, though, it's, you know, the idea of going from geochemistry to biochemistry, it's a vast gulf. It's very, very hard to understand that. But if you can imagine the origin of life now as a series of separate experimental programs, make biomolecules, make the polymers and the membranes, then find a self-replicating system, and then that system begins to evolve. If you can think of it that way, then you can set up a series of experiments that are focusing on the individual steps of the process. It makes it much easier. So, the first step, how do you make the biomolecules? Well, one of the things that seems to be fundamental to all of these studies of the origin of life is that you can't produce complexity in the system. By complexity, I mean an information-rich, small volume. That's what life is. Life is a very tiny volume with a huge amount of information collected from the environment and concentrated there. You can't do that unless you start with a complex environment. The complex environment provides the selective pressure to give you that information in a small volume. And so what kinds of complexity am I talking about? It's very simple. You need gradients, temperature, compositional gradients. You need cycles, hot, cold, wet, dry, day, night, high tide, low tide, all sorts of cycles. You need to have fluxes. These are fluid fluxes that pass over from one environment to another, that move things around. You need to have interfaces. That can be mineral surfaces in contact with water. It can be the surface of the water in contact with air. It can be aerosol particles in the upper atmosphere. That you need interfaces. And finally, you need to have chemical complexity. And one of the real key things here is that the geochemistry of Earth is incredibly complicated. You're talking about dozens and dozens of major and minor elements, not just trace elements, but major and minor elements that are in a typical geochemical environment. And to do an origin of life experiment that only uses carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen is just an unrealistic way to think about this process. Okay, so the first step is to make biomolecules. And it turns out, I'll just give you the punchline. For the last 60 years, this has been done with a vengeance in virtually any energetic environment on Earth or in space, where there's carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, and energy of some source or another, you make these molecules. You make the building blocks of life. So the idea here is to make carbon-carbon bonds. One way of thinking about it, you start with volcanic gases like carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, hydrogen disulfide, water, and you basically build carbon-carbon bonds, making two carbon molecules, three carbon molecules, and so forth. That's what we're trying to do. Now, it turns out that this was discovered very early, a way to do this in a very efficient way, and that's the classic Miller-Urey experiment. I'm sure you've heard about this experiment. Just a tabletop piece of glass apparatus, very simple, very elegant. It has on it a boiling fluid, very gently boiling water that represents the early oceans. It has an atmosphere of various gases. The original gases they used include ammonia and hydrogen, water, methane, and their little electric sparks that simulate lightning. And if you run this apparatus for 2 or 3 days, it starts, first the solution starts turning pink and then brown, and you get this black oily goo that starts forming. And you get a lot of really interesting organic molecules. In fact, many of the building blocks of life, you'll see in this list amino acids, you'll see lipids, you'll see carbohydrates, you'll see metabolic molecules, you'll see building blocks of DNA and RNA. In fact, this was so convincing, it looked like a balanced diet to people. And in fact, the experiment, in a sense, worked too well, because Stanley Miller and many of his followers, his disciples, people became religiously convinced almost that this had to be the way. It was so obvious that this was the origin of life. And so they basically denied any support for anybody else. Stanley Miller, of course, justifiably got a great deal of fame from this experiment, but the price of that fame was that he got leadership in a field which he then dominated for at least 3 decades until NASA came along. NASA came along because there are other environments that NASA specializes in besides the surface of a warm, wet planet. If life is confined only to a warm, wet planet with lightning, then you're talking about Earth and maybe Mars early on, and that's it. But there's deep space. So people like Lou Alamandola at NASA Ames try to study deep space environments by building vacuum chambers with very cold conditions, about 10 Kelvin, shining ultraviolet radiation on ices, and you can produce all kinds of interesting organic species when you do this, including amino acids, including carbohydrates, including lipids. And then the work that we began about 15 years ago is looking at high-temperature, high-pressure, black smoker, or deep volcanic environments on the floor of the ocean, something Stanley Miller hated. He called us ventists, as if we were some kind of weird cult religion. And yet, here's an energetic environment where you have a lot of chemical energy, redox energy, the very reduced sulfides coming out of these fluids in contact with much more oxidized water. And that's what life uses as its energy source, redox couples. Life are a little like electric circuits where electrons are flowing through, and this is a great way to give you that electric potential energy. And so what we did in our early experiments was to begin looking at these environments. And NASA loved this, because if life could have arisen in deep, dark, hot hydrothermal zone, then that gives you reason to study not just Mars today, because there's deep zone, but Europa and Callisto and Ganymede and Titan, and you can go down the list of all these different, even some asteroids, all possibly have hydrothermal zones where this kind of chemistry could go on. So what we did was take little gold tubes, we put various chemical ingredients, water, and maybe a little bit of organic material in there, sometimes just CO2 and water. We ran it on high-pressure, high-temperature devices. Some of this was done with Hat Yoder, who is a great colleague. He was in the laboratory every day until shortly before his death at the age of 75, an amazing guy to work with. And so we'd do these runs. We'd analyze them using various classic chemical techniques, analytical organic chemistry like gas chromatography. And the idea here is we are trying to make carbon-carbon bonds in these environments. Now, there's two kinds of carbon-carbon bonds that pop up frequently in origin of life discussions. One is making longer and longer molecules by a process called Fischer-Tropsch synthesis, basically making molecules longer by adding CH2 groups and just sort of bumping these things longer. So that's one standard process. Very typical. This is an industrial process of great importance, and it turns out this is something that you can do very easily in the lab. Another thing that you might want to do, other kinds of carbon. Oh, let me show you first one of our first experiments. This is something we did, like one of the very first naive experiments we ran in 1996. So you have just carbon dioxide, hydrogen, and water in your capsule, and you put a little bit of iron metal. We thought that might be a good catalyst. Conditions are very simple, 300 Celsius, 500 atmospheres, the kinds of conditions you might find in a deep ocean volcanic vent or in a subsurface environment. Ran the thing for 24 hours. And what we got was just an explosion of Fischer-Tropsch reactions. What you're seeing here is a small piece of a gas chromatographic trace in which you basically pass a mixture of molecules through a column, a long column, which is coated with materials so that small molecules pass through it more quickly. The larger molecules take longer. And so versus time, which is the horizontal axis, you'll see a series of spikes here, each spike representing a different compound. And the big spikes are just long chain molecules, these alkanes, and the number 18, 19, 20, and so forth, that's the number of carbon atoms that have been added. Remember, we only started with carbon dioxide. That was the only source of carbon in these runs. So we're making some really interesting things very quickly. You also see other little bumps and wiggles as you expand this. There's some alcohols in here. There's some alkenes. There's some branched hydrocarbons. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting chemistry going on in these capsules. It was very, very easy to do this. Now, there's another kind of process, too, and this is called hydroformylation, where instead of adding that CH2 group to make the molecule longer, you can add a CO. This is carbonylation or hydroformylation. You basically are adding these, and you can make longer and longer molecules. And this leads to molecules that are very important in metabolic cycles. It leads to the kind of molecules that are in the reductive TCA cycle or the Krebs cycle, which is a metabolic cycle. We'll meet that a little bit later. And so this is a very interesting set of molecules, too. And some of our experiments yielded these. And indeed, if you look at sort of a variety of transition metal sulfides, we've used lots of other minerals as well, but these are iron and copper and nickel, cobalt sulfides and so forth on the horizontal scale here. And what you see in blue, I hope there's not anybody who's colorblind who can't see this. I apologize for the color scheme. It should be changed. But some of these are very effective at Fischer-Tropsch synthesis. And when you start with a small molecule, sometimes as much as 20 or even 30% of those molecules are elongated through this process. And others, particularly the cobalt and the nickel sulfides, are very efficient at hydroformylation. In that case, sometimes over 30% of the molecules are elongated in this way. Now, what this is telling us is that if you have a natural geochemical environment on the ocean floor in these black smokers, where you have nickel and cobalt and iron and copper sulfides all mixed together, that the molecules are going to be produced in profusion, and you're going to add to do a hydroformylation here, you're going to do a Fischer-Tropsch reaction over here, and this doesn't even bring in nitrogen when you start adding amine groups and making esters and all sorts of interesting chemistries going on. In fact, you just get a flood of chemistry. So this kind of process is really interesting, and for those of you who are wondering about why this chemistry works, it really has to do with the bonding of CO particularly strongly to these. That's where the hydroformylation comes in. So there's a lot of details here. I mean, George Cody could give you an incredible lecture on every chemical step that he's found, and it's a fascinating process. But the really bottom line is that making these molecules is straightforward. We now know half a dozen different ways and plausible prebiotic environments to make the small molecules of life. This was really a critical part. And I'm pleased to say, as a card-carrying mineralogist, that it looks like minerals played a fundamental role here. Minerals are going to come back again, and I have to give you a warning here, because there is a curiosity about origin of life research. It's just a fact of life that humans see in the natural world what they know best. I'm a mineralogist, therefore the origin of life revolves around minerals. There are other people who are molecular biologists as they study DNA and RNA, and for them the origin of life is all about DNA and RNA. There are lipid chemists who have proposed the lipid world. There are people who study polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. For them, it's the PA world. Everybody sees in the origin of life what they've got their PhD in. I got my PhD in mineralogy, but I am pleased to tell you, in spite of that fact, in spite of the caveat, minerals have played a key role in the origin of life, and so it's really fun to be able to talk about that tonight. Okay. So you made these molecules. It's easy to make the molecules. But then you have to do something useful with them. And one of the difficulties here is that the prebiotic processes I've told you about make vast numbers of molecules, not just a few dozen or a few hundred molecules. They make tens of thousands of different molecular species. But life isn't like that. Life has an incredible degree of molecular selectivity and idiosyncratic use of molecules. You know, there's a catalog of all the known organic species. This relatively small organic molecules is called Bielstein. And last time I looked, it was 6 or 7 million different molecules. Now, E. coli, that's a very common single-celled organism that you've probably heard about. Guess how many different small molecules there are in E. coli? Remember, 6 to 7 million to work with. It's 500. 500 different small molecules in E. coli. Now, that's incredible selection out of all those possible molecules. So that was a really good guess, though. I mean, some people, you know, I would have guessed 100,000 or something like that. So you have to ask this question: what prebiotic processes contribute to this selection and concentration? That becomes a really fundamental thing. Well, I think there are two processes that were at work here, and I think we understand both of them fairly well, at least in general terms. And the first is self-selection or self-organization. And let me tell you the story about one of the very first experiments that we did. It was actually kind of naive in retrospect, but it was clever at the time. This reverse citric acid cycle, or the TCA cycle I was telling you about, has several steps. And what we thought is if we could show that minerals catalyze those steps, then you could show that the citric acid cycle is a core metabolic foundation of all life and it just arose spontaneously, and you'd have that cycle and that would be, you know, problem solved, basically. So one of the key steps in that reverse cycle is going from the 3-carbon molecule pyruvic acid to the 4-carbon molecule oxaloacetic acid. And so we thought if we went to high pressure and took pyruvic acid and added CO2, that you'd just go from 3+1 to 4, and we make a lot of oxaloacetic acid, and that would be a nice science paper, and we'd be able to do this in a week. That's not what happened. We ran these pyruvic acid in very simple conditions, 200 Celsius, 2,000 atmospheres, 2 hours, just perfectly normal conditions. So you start out by putting this tiny drop of pyruvic acid into the capsule with a small amount of water and CO2, and so it's just a colorless liquid. There's just not much stuff there. And after you pull the capsules out, they're all puffed up. They're all swollen. So we knew there was a lot of internal gas pressure. And so you got to be a little careful, these things, because you can generate a lot of gas if you break down the pyruvic acid. So we put it in. We first put it in liquid nitrogen. We froze it down and then snipped off the end. And we went, bang! You know, it just was like, it's like there still was a lot of pressure even after you froze the thing down. Drop it into a vial and it just sits there. And after about 30 seconds, it starts hissing and foaming. And this yellow, brown, oily goo starts pouring out of the capsule. Okay, we started with one little drop of pyruvic acid. Where did all this stuff come from? And then the smell. The smell. You know, organic molecules can smell a lot of different ways. at lower temperature, 200 Celsius or so, it smells like molasses, a very sweet, sugary smell. And if you get up to around 300, it smells exactly like Jack Daniels. It's the most amazing thing. I mean, and it just fills the room, and people would walk by our laboratory and they'd say, "Can I have some? Where's the party?" You know, they want to, and it's just, so you're making really interesting organic molecules, right? I mean, the thing is, you're not making oxaloacetic acid here. We're making something else. And so then we run that GC that I was telling you about, and it's just a mess. I mean, this is what chemists call humpane. That is, it's 10,000 or more different molecules are being produced here. I mean, this pyruvic acid, it cyclizes, deals aldol condensation, it polymerizes, it fragments in different ways. Every one of those peaks, it's just a complete mess. And the trouble is here, this is very, very typical of these kinds of experiments. The problem is that you're making too many different molecules. Remember, life only uses a few. And yet, here you're making this vast number of molecules. So, how do you deal with this? And we just sort of lamented that we just sort of had run into a complete dead end because this couldn't have anything to do with the origin of life. And then we talked to our friend David Deamer at the University of California, Santa Cruz, who's a world's expert on lipid self-organization. He said, "Well, have you tried putting it in water?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, maybe it'll self-organize." And then he said, "You need to characterize." And so we went to Marilyn Fogel, who's an analytic organic chemist at our laboratory, and she showed that we had made a huge number of molecules that were 10, 11, 12, 13 carbon atoms long, lipid-type molecules, very interesting lengths for self-organization. By the way, you notice everybody's smiling. Origin of life, people are very commonly smiling. This is a lot of fun. I mean, this is so that's just a something. And yes, indeed, what was happening, they said, well, maybe these things will self-organize. And the self-organization they're talking about is what basically goes into forming cell membranes as well. It's a lipid bilayer. These are molecules that are hydrophilic. They like water at one end. They're hydrophobic at the other end. And so when you put them in water, the molecules find each other. They line up so that the water-loving ends are on the outside, on the inside of a sphere, and all the little tails that hate water are as far away from water as possible. And when we threw this stuff in water, bingo, these just appear. And they're fluorescent. I mean, they're just gorgeous little objects. And so in spite of the fact that we made thousands of different molecules, some subset of those molecules in water self-organize, and they make these membranes. And it's very clear now. I mean, you find this when you extract molecules from the Murchison meteorite, when you extract molecules from Lou Alamandola's experiment, just, you know, from the Miller-Urey experiment. Anytime you do that, you get this phenomenon. So clearly, one step in the origin of life is the selection and concentration of molecules through molecular self-organization. They find each other, and they select, and they make these structures. Now, these aren't cell membranes, but they show that this process is so intrinsic. It's a deterministic aspect of that early world. Okay. Oh, that's a really interesting question. We haven't done that experiment. It's a very robust process, though. I mean, you can boil this water, and they still organize themselves. You can put salt in this water. I mean, this is stuff if you use pure molecules, they tend not to do very well under these extreme conditions. But this stuff, this goes gangbusters. So it looks like this is really a very intrinsic part of the natural world, making these kinds of tiny units with insides and outsides. Now, as you know, many molecules that are important to biology are water-soluble. Many of the amino acids, certainly the sugars, they don't, they dissolve in water, so they're not going to self-organize in this way. And furthermore, there's an additional complication that many of these molecules come in left- and right-handed pairs. And the trouble is that when you do the prebiotic synthesis, you make a 50-50 mixture of them, and yet when you look at life uses the left-handed amino acids predominantly, and it uses the right-handed sugars. And so there's a chiral handedness, a chiral selection that's going on, and that's a big mystery. And so one of the things we're wondering, how in the world does that happen? As a mineralogist, I went back to the mineral world, and one of our hypotheses was that perhaps mineral surfaces play a role. What you see here is a schematic diagram of a crystal of calcite, a very common calcium carbonate mineral. It's the mineral that forms the shells of snails and clams and limestone, coral reefs, and so forth. And it has left and right-handed surfaces, and our hypothesis is the surfaces might selectively concentrate left and right-handed molecules, and this would be a way then to organize things to select them. Well, it turns out that this is a very important question. Chirality is important. You can imagine how left and right-handed molecules form because you have a central carbon atom with four different things attached to it, and you can attach them clockwise or counterclockwise, if you will. So clearly, this is important to questions of the origin of life, but it goes far beyond that because if you've bought drugs lately, the chances are that some of the drugs you're buying are chirally pure. That is, they have to be refined. And most of the synthesis processes, it's easier to make a combination of left and right-handed molecules at the same time. So to make them chirally pure is very expensive. And so this is now a $200 billion a year industry, and any new ways of separating molecules is important. It's important for a number of reasons. Some of them are just kind of amusing. There is a left and right-handed version of a molecule called limonene. The one version smells and tastes like oranges. The other version smells and tastes like lemons. And the reason, and these are both used as fragrances or flavors, and the reason this is, happens is because, of course, the molecules that form your taste buds are themselves chiral, and so they're sensitive to, just like a left and a right hand fitting a glove, they react differently to different shaped molecules. A more sinister aspect is the thalidomide story, where one version cured morning sickness, but the other version caused birth defects. And the trouble here is even if you have a chirally pure form of thalidomide in your body, it undergoes a process called racemization, that is flipping from the left to the right-handed form and back. So over a period of 24 hours, you might take the chirally pure form, but within a few hours, you've been poisoned by the other. And so this really is a very serious concern. Okay, so here we have this conundrum. Prebiotic synthesis makes 50-50 mixtures. Life uses very pure forms of left or right. And so you have to ask, what's the mechanism of symmetry breaking? And so again, one of the hypotheses we've been looking at is the possibility that minerals do this. There are natural minerals that are chiral. Quartz is the most common example. And the reason there are right and left-handed quartz crystals is because one of the structural elements is a helix. And it can either be a helix up to the right or a helix up to the left. And so you get these two different versions of quartz, left and right. Now, one of the things people always used to do is take quartz crystals, a left crystal or right crystal, and crush it into an extremely fine powder. And the reason for that is if you want to do experiments on surfaces, it's better to have a large surface area, and a fine powder is going to increase your surface area. The trouble is that destroys a very important piece of information. And I first sort of realized this when I was a mineral collector as a teenager. I went to Paterson, New Jersey, and I collected this sample of quartz crystals, the biggest ones here about a millimeter across. So when you look at these under higher magnification, what you see is that there's a red coating, that's hematite, that's iron oxide. And the iron oxide is not uniformly coating these crystals, rather it's coating only alternate faces. Quartz has threefold symmetry, not sixfold symmetry. So the six little triangular faces include three of one kind and three of another kind. And what we're seeing here is the fundamental importance. So if you're talking about interactions between a molecule and a crystal, the different faces are fundamentally important because they have completely different surface structures. So hematite sticks to one face, it doesn't stick to the other face. That's going to be true of any kind of molecular selection. So if you want to try to understand chiral selection of mineral surface, you grind up the crystal, you're destroying all that information. So a lot of our research in the last few years has been devoted to taking single crystal specimens of minerals, things like feldspar, the commonest mineral of the alkalis and aluminosilicate, diopside, a member of the pyroxene family, which are the commonest magnesium and iron minerals, and here again is calcite. All of these minerals have natural chiral surfaces. If you find really nice crystals with mirror smooth surfaces, you can do experiments on them, various optical, spectroscopic, chemical absorption experiments, and actually see the difference in the absorption. And And that's another whole talk, exactly how we do that and the experiments. It's really fascinating work. The bottom line is this works. And you can take crystals and show that you get significant concentrations of left and right-handed molecules separating onto faces. Now, as many of you will anticipate, in the early Earth, there were equal numbers of left and right-handed faces. But what you get here is you get the advantage, you get local environments, local surfaces, local volumes where you're concentrating left-handed molecules over here, right-handed molecules over here. And if you think about the origin of life, it really had to be at a collection of molecules at a place and a time in a very small volume. And so here you have an incredible number of experiments going on different mineral surfaces in different places. Each one of those an experiment of molecular selection, concentration, templating, organization, and maybe then further we see polymerization on some of these surfaces. We can also understand in some detail why this is true, by the way. This isn't just sort of magic. If you look at the surface structure, this is a density functional calculation of left and right-handed aspartic acid on that calcite surface that I just showed you. And when you bring the molecules close, you can basically try different configurations and find the minimum energy configuration of the molecule on the surface. And when you do that, the D-aspartate attaches very nicely on three different points of attachment. In order to have a chiral selection, you need to have three non-collinear points. It's like if you go bowling, you know, there are left-handed bowling balls and right-handed bowling balls, and if you're right-handed, you can't use a left-handed bowling ball and vice versa. Well, it's the three points. Well, when you look at the L absorption, there's only two points of attachment. The surface becomes much more distorted. And it's just simply a geometrical fact that these three points fit on that surface and these don't. And of course, then, if you look at the mirror image surface, the right-handed one fits better than the left-handed. So the thing that's really amazing, there's an 8 kilocalorie per mole difference than this. That's a huge energetic difference, which essentially means that under room temperatures and if you had an idealized surface of this sort, that you'd have more than 99% enantioselectivity on the two faces. So it's a pretty major effect. Now, there's still a huge number of experiments to be done. There's so many surfaces. There's so many different molecules. And to understand all the details is going to take a lot of years of work. But the fundamental thing here is that the second emergent step, that is selection and concentration of just the right elements, we know it can happen by self-organization of some molecules like lipids and by surface templating of other molecules on mineral surfaces. So, you know, we really have the basic idea of how this works. Okay, now step three, and this is the biggie, and this has not been solved yet, but there's a huge amount of work, both experimental and theoretical, on how you make a self-replicating system. How do you make a set of molecules that copies itself? One of the sort of fundamental systems in all biology, a core metabolic cycle of every living thing, is this reverse citric acid cycle. It's a series of molecules going from very simple molecules, CO2, 2 carbon acetic acid, 3 carbon pyruvic acid, 4 carbon oxaloacetic acid. You go around this cycle to 6 carbon citric acid, and then that splits into 2 plus 4, and then 2 plus 4. And then that you have 2 cycles, and then those split, and then you have 4, and then you have 8, and you just double each time you go around the cycle. This is an engine of synthesis. And furthermore, as you go off the site here, if you add amino groups and other kinds of very simple chemical steps, just a few steps away are all the amino acids, the building blocks of DNA and RNA. So you can do a lot with a citric acid cycle. This is a great source of metabolic creativity. And one of the things we've been trying to do is come up with experimental approaches where you use mineral catalysts and make each of these steps go. This has sort of been our guiding light, and this has been Harold Morowitz at George Mason University. He, for many years, was at Yale, theoretical biologist, who has basically been pushing this idea that a deterministic aspect of life anywhere in the cosmos is going to be this reverse citric acid cycle. It uses just carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, and the small molecules are very simple. There's no chiral step in this, by the way, so this is a pre-chiral kind of situation, and he's very persuasive about this as one possibility. Now, we've been trying to do this. This is mostly work of George Cody, and this very complicated spaghetti diagram shows some of the pathways that we have demonstrated, but also there are a few key ones that we have not. So of the 11 main reactions in that cycle, we've basically got 9 of them to go. 8 of them go pretty easily. The 9th one is sort of a tenuous thing, but 2 of them, including that pyruvic to oxaloacetic, we've not had any success in getting that to go under any of the catalytic circumstances. So maybe it is, maybe there's some special set of circumstances that allows that to happen, but that's one possibility. So we're studying this as a possible self-replicating cycle that may have gotten going just through mineral catalysts. There are other ideas out there, though. Stuart Kaufman at the Santa Fe Institute came up with this idea of an autocatalytic network of molecules. And this is really kind of the opposite. Instead of just using a few molecules making a simple cycle, he says, let's take advantage of the fact that we have tens of thousands of different molecules. And when you do, some of those molecules are going to catalyze the formation of others, and they're going to catalyze the breakdown of others. And so eventually you're going to end up with a network of molecules, all of whom reinforce themselves but destroy anything that's not in that network. So this becomes a collection. And he says it may be 1,000, it may be 10,000 different molecules to begin with. And so you have some chemical milieu in which all these molecules are interacting and breaking down and reinforcing and catalyzing each other. And that becomes kind of the core network of self-replicating molecules, even though it's not bound by any membrane or anything. It's just, and then gradually, as the molecules become more efficient at replicating some of them, they're going to start forming new combinations that catalyze a smaller number. And the core set of molecules gets smaller and smaller and smaller until you get basically down to something that can be encapsulated. Now, when you ask Stuart Kaufman, well, what chemicals are you talking about with molecules, he says that's for the chemists to figure out. So I'm not sure if, you know, this is going very far experimentally. It's very hard to deal with a collection of 10,000 unspecified molecules and see if they, in fact, are autocatalytic. But it's an interesting idea that's out there, and it does make reference to the fact that the early geochemical environments on Earth are going to be extremely chemically complex. And this builds in that complexity. And then there's the people who promote the RNA world, the idea that RNA has this ability both to carry information. Presumably, you could have a self-replicating RNA molecule that could also act as a catalyst, because there are these ribozymes, enzymes, that use the RNA building blocks. So that sort of RNA does it all. And the idea that this has been very seductive to people in molecular biology, and that's why I say, for them, this is the answer to the origin of life. They say, all you need to do is show us a way to make a self-replicating RNA molecule, and then we've solved the whole thing. And then metabolism just sort of gets layered on it somehow to make things more efficient. Well, the RNA world dilemma is that, you know, it's a great way to potentially make copies of yourself. It's a great way to carry information. It's possibly a great way to catalyze reactions. But there's no known way to synthesize it. No one has been able to figure out a way how to do that. And so you really have to figure out, you've got the prebiotic soup with all of these potential building blocks of life, and then you've got the RNA world, and that gap's a big one to fill. So that's really a mystery. And I think the conclusion for step 3 has to be that, you know, we haven't solved this yet. The self-replicating system is the fundamental divide, is the fundamental gap, and that's what the most exciting work in the origin of life is on right now. I think it's going to be done. I think there's going to be a laboratory system, a plausible prebiotic system that will be shown. There's work at Harvard. There's work at Scripps. There's work at other laboratories in Europe that I think are really on the right track here. But, you know, if we knew all the answers, it wouldn't be fun to get up in the morning, right? I mean, that's why we do science. Anyway, once you have the emergence of a self-replicating system, I will argue that the emergence of natural selection must follow. It's inevitable to follow. This kind of selective process is going to be inevitable when you have a self-replicating system of organic molecules. Because organic molecules are incredibly mutable. With very, very small energy differences, you can replace a hydrogen with a CH3. You can replace an OH group with an SH group. You can, you know, all the different things you can do with organic chemistry. And this is going to have happened. And so it's inevitable that when you have self-replicating system of molecules, there are going to be variants of those molecules that come along that do things slightly better. And because they're making copies of themselves and therefore competing for the resources in the environment, any increase in efficiency is going to be rewarded very, very quickly. Okay, so this just, I think, is going to happen. But I don't have to just wave my arms about this. There is actually a laboratory demonstration of how this can happen. And some of you may know about Jack Szostak, a colleague who's at Harvard University, won the Nobel Prize a few years ago for work not related to what I'm going to tell you about, but he has worked on something called aptamer evolution. This is molecular evolution that's now a $1 billion-a-year industry because it's such a powerful way of taking one molecule to target another molecule. So here's what he does. Okay, he starts with a molecule that he wants to target. He wants to have basically have a molecule that's designed to bind to another one. And so he uses a molecule called GTP. The molecule called GTP is attached to little beads which are put in test tubes or beakers. So they're just sort of hanging out there into a solution. And then he makes an amazing random pool of RNA fragments, 10 to the 14th different randomly produced strands of RNA. And these RNA strands are, you know, typically on the order of 100 mers, so 100 RNA letters long. And a strand that's 100 RNA molecules long will fold up in some way. And most of the times it folds up in ways that have absolutely nothing to do with binding to a GTP molecule. But once every so often, and when you make 10 to the 14th different versions, some of those will sort of loosely bind to the GTP. So the neat thing you can do is a sequence of experiments where you take that beaker filled with little balls that have the GTP on it, you pour in your solution of 10 to the 14th molecules, some of them stick, you let it sit there for 20 minutes or whatever, stir it around, and then you pour out the solution. And you're pouring out most of those 10 to the 14th molecules, but remaining on the GTP are a few RNA molecules that stick fairly well. And so you basically wash those, you collect them, you then go through a series of standard genetic processes that turns the RNA into DNA, you copy it, you then basically mutate it while you're doing that, and you make another 10 to the 14th strand. But in this case, every one of those 10 to the 14th strands is now a mutant of one that used to stick a little bit. And so in the second cycle of this process, it sticks much better. And some of those stick extremely well. And when you do this, just a half a dozen cycles, you end up with a molecule that sticks with absolutely the optimum theoretical maximum binding energy. It's as good as anything could possibly stick. Now you think about it, it's 100 mer. And so there are four different DNA or RNA letters, and that's 4 to the 100th power different possible combinations. If you were to ask a theoretical chemist to, okay, calculate for me an RNA 100 mer that's going to bind optimally to a GNA target. At this point, there's not enough computational power in the world to come close to that. Maybe someday when we have principles, there will be, but now you can't do it. But using this, you can do it in a couple of days. And you basically use evolution, molecular evolution, simply by selecting for a particular function. And every time you do it, you come up with a molecule that's optimally engineered to do this. So turns out evolution is an incredibly powerful way to design something. If you want to, you know, why would you use intelligent design when you could use evolution to do this? The other thing that's kind of intriguing about this process is, remember what I said right at the beginning, that if you're going to generate complexity, you need complexity in your environment. You need to have gradients, you need to have fluxes, you need to have cycles, you need to have interfaces, you need to have chemical complexity. And that's exactly what you have in Jack Szostak's experiment. Right? I mean, you have random RNA pool, that's chemical complexity. Got in vitro processes, that's interfaces. You have fluxes, you have gradients, and you have cycles. It's all there, and that's what drives evolution. It's not, by the way, a random process. It's a selective process, and selection, by definition, has deterministic aspects. So it's really intriguing to see this come into play. And this is going to happen on the prebiotic earth because you have all those selective processes going on. Okay, so I think what we see is you can imagine the origin of life in four emergent steps. First one is synthesizing the biomolecules. The second one is assembling those molecules into some kind of functional polymers to membranes and so forth. Then comes the big question mark. That's how you get to the self-replicating system. We're still working on that hard, but once you have the self-replicating system, the natural selection just follows inevitably. That's a really exciting experimental approach to the origin of life. I know time is getting late, but I want to tell you about one other new thing that's come along which may short-circuit this whole process in a way that you know, a few years ago we couldn't have imagined. I've been fortunate enough to be involved in a new scientific program called the Deep Carbon Observatory. We're studying all aspects of carbon within the Earth, including deep life. And all around the world now, people are drilling deep wells to look for microbes. It turns out that anywhere you drill, mile two, 3 miles down, and you bring up the drill core, there's microbes living in the rocks. And typically, if you get below temperatures of about 150 Celsius, you don't see cellular life anymore. But there are now a couple of anecdotal reports. I can tell you more about it if you want to know. But there are a couple of anecdotal reports that something is happening above 150 Celsius. And it's not cells. But it seems like there's some kind of organized molecular systems down there. And what is it? And here's one possibility that I've been talking to my colleagues about. And right now, this is a very viable thought. Imagine that cellular life as we know it today, with DNA and RNA and proteins, really does have a temperature limit because some of those molecules are relatively delicate and so the whole systems break down. And that cellular life as we know it probably doesn't survive. But that doesn't mean that there couldn't be self-replicating molecular systems that go to much higher temperatures, that are much more robust. The suggestions from these early sort of anecdotal accounts is there's some kind of biofilms being formed. They're not cells. They're two-dimensional surfaces that are multi-molecular thick, and they're growing on mineral surfaces. They're growing laterally. They grow more intensively on surfaces that have lots of redox potential. They look like electrolytic gels of some kind. And it's possible these self-organizing systems on mineral surfaces really represent a kind of, I don't know, you want to call it ur-life? We just don't have a taxonomy for what it is. It's something. No one knows yet. They have not yet done the sufficient molecular analysis. It looks like there's polysaccharides. This has not been published yet. There's some data from China. There's data from this Juan de Fuca Ridge. And so the question is, if you have a kind of molecular system that can self-replicate, may not be cells, but if it has the chemical energy, if it has the resources to build itself and grow however slowly, and if it lives above 150 Celsius, where it's beyond the predation of cellular life, then there has been a continuous subsurface network of environments that are above 150 Celsius since the Hadean, since the earliest time of Earth history. This could be a remnant of an early stage of life's origin, of molecular self-organization, which has persisted because it's self-replicating and very robust, and has survived because it's at a temperature higher than cells can eat it. And it could be, in fact, a remnant for the origin of life. So one possibility is that we can then actually find on Earth today those precursor biochemistries, the molecules of life and how they're organized. And how deep could these go? Well, it's pretty amazing if you think about subduction zones. Certainly there are 150 Celsius environments at 40 kilometers. So 40 kilometers down in a very fast cold subducting slab, you could have cellular life. That's pretty amazing in itself. But isn't it not possible that even much deeper there's this other domain of something, some kind of organic chemistry that can give us real hints about the origin of life. So if you want to know more about the Deep Carbon Observatory and the kinds of things we're studying, there's a website, and I'd be very happy to tell you more about that later on. The conclusions, I think, are pretty straightforward. I think the origin of life is best understood as a series of emergent steps. You go from geochemical relative simplicity to biochemical complexity as a series of steps that can be replicated in laboratory experiments. It's clear we don't have all the answers at this point. But that's the excitement of science, is to find out. And we're certainly well on our way. And I have to end on one sort of philosophical note again. This whole scenario I've described to you is very disturbing to some people. Some of our friends and relatives and colleagues from around the country and around the world are very disturbed by the idea that origin of life is just a chemical process, a geochemistry that's led to biochemistry. How can we be created in God's image if it's just a bunch of random molecules that get mixed together? And I understand that, and I sympathize with that. I think we all need to recognize that that's a point of view out there. What I would like to be able to communicate to them is a different way of thinking about life and, in fact, the universe as a sequence of emergent steps which are inevitable and inexorable. They're part of the very fabric of the cosmos. That from the Big Bang inevitably came hydrogen. From hydrogen came stars. From stars came the whole periodic table of the elements. From that periodic table came Earth-like planets. Earth-like planets, again, another emergent step leads to the early steps in the origin of life itself, and eventually to us, and to a universe that is learning to know itself. Thank you very much. Please, questions. I'd love questions.
Couple of questions. About this hydrosomal system that you said you need a cycle, and wondering, in that environment, actually, you don't have day and night, and you did mention that. I wonder if it's misspoken or is it something you do expect some sort of cyclicity in that environment.
Question. Yes, certainly in hydrothermal zones deep on the ocean floor, what you're much more experiencing very intense fluxes, geochemical complexity, you have interfaces, you have very strong gradients. The cycles are much more subtle and may not play much of a role. One interesting hypothesis that's out there, though, is that water has a critical point, and it's a specific temperature, specific pressure. And there are depths of the ocean where there are volcanic systems which are at very close to that critical point in terms of temperature and in terms of pressure. And just simply the tides rising and falling will cause the critical point to go through a volume of rock on a daily basis. And as Alex can tell you, there are amazing things that happen chemically at critical points, and it's very possible that those specific volumes of the crust are where the most exciting action happens. So there's a cycle that does occur, but I agree with you that on ocean floor, the day-night wet-dry cycles are not nearly as they're not going to occur.
Okay, so that answers my question. So the second question of ordering is the chirality. That, I mean, I realize you are coming from a large background and sort of rely on mineral surface with the tree. But it's an underlying implication that what you're saying is actually somehow all the life actually originated from that one accident rather than sort of spawning out all over the place. If it's all over the place, then that's inevitable that is some surface actually gets stained in other surfaces that the right hand. Life actually somehow got all or left handed. So I don't think mineral will do the job.
Yes, okay. This is a very interesting point. It addresses some of the philosophical questions, but let me get you thinking about it this way. Okay, what is the reactive area that's important in any one of these experiments? And I would say it's probably a few hundred nanometers on a side. That's the kind of molecular surface area. And if you basically do a quick back-of-the-envelope calculation, I could be off by many orders of magnitude, But basically, if you look at the surface of the Earth, the total surface area of the minerals, you're talking about something in the order of 10 to the 30th, 10 to the 40th separate little experimental surface areas. And then you integrate that over, and say an experiment takes a few seconds, and the molecules then rearrange themselves. And you have 500 million years to play with. You're talking about on the order of 10 to the 50th different molecular experiments of juxtapositions. So, yes, indeed, it's certainly true that it may be random whether it starts here or starts here or someplace else. But start thinking about those combinatorics of the number of different individual experiments on surfaces. You know, in a laboratory, it takes us weeks to do one experiment of one kind of molecule on the surface. But in a prebiotic environment, you could have this huge number, and therefore it becomes perhaps not a random thing. It becomes totally deterministic.
Unless you rely on one particular mineral and one particular surface that happens to select only the left-hand side and keeps starting to move.
Here's a different scenario. Initially, you have a lot of mineral surfaces. You create little left-handed universes, little right-handed universes. Then through the next sets of synthesis, one of those becomes more efficient. And after a period of competition, one of them will prevail, simply because it eats the others.
Right.
That's the idea, yeah. So that if you have enough of these experiments going on, some of them are going to be more efficient than others, and they're going to eventually arise.
The cultural chemical aspect is actually UV, for example, preferentially.
Yes.
Right-hand side.
And you're absolutely right about this, that there are many other ways that chirality may have arisen, that there may be some cosmic scale, the CP violation has built-in chirality. When you have beta decay, electrons are chiral only in one sense. And if that could cause a chemical effect, biasing towards one kind of molecule or another, or if there's circularly polarized synchrotron radiation from a rapidly rotating neutron star, that could also cause local environments where you had a predominance of one candidness or another. Or, in a completely different vein, individual chiral molecules are themselves very strong chiral centers. And you can have chiral organization around a molecule independent of a mineral surface completely. So there are many different hypotheses, many, many hypotheses about how chirality arose. What I was trying to indicate tonight, more importantly, is that there are plausible ways to explain chirality, and mineral surfaces are one of them. So, but you're absolutely right that they're, you know, when you go to chirality conferences, you'll have 20 people with 20 different ideas about this. Hi, Julia, yes.
So is a self-replicating system necessarily made of organic
molecules? There is one very highly publicized point of view by a British scientist named Graham Cairns-Smith. And he argues for the clay world. He's a clay mineralogist, so what else is new? But he suggests that clay minerals, because of their very complicated layer structures and their variability, the fact that they can stack in different ways, could carry a kind of genetic information which might make more copies of themselves, and then under certain pressure, temperature, and aqueous fluid compositions, certain clay combinations become self-replicating, and they dominate a suite of clays, and then some became the templates for organic molecules which followed, and that the first life, he talks about clay life as being the first life form. Crystal chemically, it just doesn't work. It falls apart. If you accept, as any crystal chemist knows, that nearest neighbor interactions are much stronger than more distant interactions, there's no way for a clay layer up here to communicate to a clay layer down there what its orientation is. And even spiral growth mechanisms, there's no clear way to break clays apart into many little fragments.
But you form polytypes that are huge.
You form polytypes that are huge, but then how do you break those clay fragments apart to then essentially replicate in two different environments? And then how do they mutate? And then how do you template the clays with organics to make the organic life form. In other words, it's such a complicated and implausible mechanism to my point of view. But it is out there. There's whole books about this.
And yet, the major reactivity on clays is not on the layers, but on the edge sites.
The edge sites.
You can almost imagine that you've got one clay, it's got these edge sites, and then it goes to the next one.
It's certainly, it would be nice to be able to test it. Unfortunately, the biggest impediment to testing this is that, you know, huge billions of dollars have been put into learning how to sequence DNA and RNA. No one's going to put billions of dollars into learn how to sequence clays. So it's really hard to test.
What about an immense contamination problem?
Yeah, no. Yes?
Particular phases of nanominerals be more common in particular environments, so it would be, for instance, more beneficial environment where the right and the left hand might be formed. For instance, we were talking earlier about the rutile structure of the oxide assemblage, you know, 110, and then you hydrate that surface, and it might become a vehicle for this particular kind of prebiotic surface chemistry.
Yeah,
environment, maybe
marine environments. Yeah, so the question, it has to do with the energetics and the amount of mineral surface area. And the two things that come immediately in mind are those black smokers, all the sulfides that are coming out are nanoparticles, and of course clays, which are formed as weathering products. So both clays and hydrothermal systems. So zones of serpentinization, for example, you're going to have huge surface areas being produced there as well. So there are natural geochemical environments in which the surface areas are very, very high.
Something about supercritical water that triggered a new thought in my mind, and then, of course, the chemical engineers are using supercritical CO2 as a remarkable solvent for organic reactions. And they're making little vesicles in which the CO2 is, et cetera. So then the obvious question is, are there environments in the early Earth and other planets and wherever that that's basically the sheltered environment?
Maybe. That's interesting. Yeah. Let's go.
If you look at the origin of the universe, you start from a Big Bang and everything comes from that. And it's true that you form galaxies and stars and planets and ultimately human beings. But as I understand it, and this is not my complete area, as I understand it, you're always going to try to make the whole system more random. But in order to get what you want to do, you've got to make it less random. Now I understand you can overcome the entropy by making it more stable in some way. But has anybody just looked at the overall thermodynamics to make sure that all of this makes sense?
Ilya Prigogine got a Nobel Prize for that. Yeah, it's he talked about dissipative systems, and it's non-equilibrium thermodynamics. It's
your idea of concentrating in a small volume at the expense of the rest.
So Ilya Prigogine is the name of the person who, and everything I've said about, you know, concentrating information is just parroting things that have been said for 30 years. So I think it's a fundamental organizing principle of the cosmos, and the fact that it's not sort of a separate law of thermodynamics, you know. I'm not sure what allows something to become a law of thermodynamics as opposed to just a corollary or a lemma or whatever. But to me, this is an absolute as important a principle, as important a law of the cosmos as the first and second laws of thermodynamics. And it just hasn't been articulated that way.
Just an observation question. So 60% of the United States citizens don't believe in evolution. So there is this sort of phase separation between scientists and a big part of the country. So somehow what you are saying is a sort of heresy for the majority. At the end of the day, I was wondering how to communicate with the other system, which is a big problem in a science, because yeah. sooner or later we have to face the money issue.
So the question is, how do I communicate these ideas to audiences that are not as sympathetic as this one? And I've done this. I mean, I've gone to, you know, creationist groups in Iowa and in South Carolina and in Kansas and in other places where this is a huge debate. And what I try to say is that, I mean, look, if you want to understand the origin of life, if you believe in a creator and you want to understand origin of life, read Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. And what that says to me is, if you wish to believe that there is a creator that's done this, the way to know the creator is to study creation, is to study what the universe is like. And when you do that, you see that there's this tremendous creative drive, this evolutionary drive built into the cosmos. It's a fundamental part of what we see it all around us all the time. That in spite of the second law that was alluded to earlier, you know, in springtime, new plants arise and we see children born and grow from a single cell. I mean, it's we see this all the time. We see it all around us. It's not a violation of natural law. It is in fact a fundamental natural law, and it's an extraordinary part of, if you want to believe in a creator, it's part of understanding what how the creator did it. And so I don't see the conflict between that. I mean, that's a very spiritual way of thinking about what we as scientists study. And so I try to make that connection. And for some people it works, and a lot of people it doesn't. But I respect people who are of faith. If they have a deep faith, that's one of their ways of knowing, and you can't tell them they're wrong. What you have to do is say, here's how the way I see the world meshes with the way you see the world. Yeah.
But they don't see how they see the world meshes with the way you see the world.
Yeah, I know. I mean, but it's a matter of being respectful to different ways of knowing. I mean, epistemologies, you know, can we as a scientist prove that our way is better? I mean, we believe it is, but that's a belief, but there's no concrete way of proving that to somebody else, so you have to basically understand what...
I suppose another way of saying it is, we provide mechanisms as to how, if there's a question as to why, and I'm not sure there's a question as to why, but if there is a question as to why, then that is basically in the realm of religion.
But we can inform that question. And if you really want to understand a creator, why wouldn't you study?
Well, even more simple than that is, if I'm created in God's image, then how am I supposed to turn around and visualize what or who is God? Because then I'm creating God in my image, and that is heresy.
I wouldn't go there with these audiences. Yes, hi.
I have a question. The steps of the successful are basically inevitable and occur over and over again and without much difficulty. And the critical step, which is one of self-replication, seems to be very difficult to manage in some way. And the thing is that if it was relatively easy, we would be, new life forms would be reproducing all the time.
Very good point.
In real
yeah.
time.
So yeah.
There is a missing link here in the argument. And really it speaks to the sort of uncomfortable situation that there is some kind of special event or occasion or process or environment where this must happen. And when this happens, this process, this phenomena, doesn't repeat itself in his sort of geological history or the history of the environment, or maybe since the nuclear synthesis of the state elements that you're working with. So it points to a kind of a special situation, which is uncomfortable if you're a scientist, right?
But is it uncomfortable? Is it really uncomfortable?
No, actually, I don't find it uncomfortable, yeah. But I can see how it would sort of allow, open an argument for special creation.
But if that special situation were something like that deep environment that doesn't have cells but has the molecules, and that's where they learn to replicate.
No, but what we're doing is we're escaping. I think the deep environment is a good place to look, but I don't think we're going to find
But then, in another sense, it just says we have not done the right experiment.
Yeah.
That's the point I'm trying to make, is that all these other experiments, they're going on all the time, different kinds of natural environments.
Yeah.
But this experiment for replication, that experiment is not going on.
At least we haven't recognized it yet, that's true.
That's fine. I mean, that's another way.
But the
other side of the argument is that there is a special situation.
Yeah, but special situations have happened throughout the history of Earth. The moon forming event was a singularity. The beginning of plate tectonics, from going from a vertical kind of plume tectonics to that, was a transition in Earth history.
These chemical special situation rather than there have been
lots of irreversible singularity events, and this is just one of them, I think.
Physical, chemical.
Yeah, I mean, you can think of the initiation of subduction, which was not, modern plate tectonics. The great oxidation event. Of course, that was biological, but it certainly was. You know, the snowball Earth events. No, I understand your point. It's a very interesting one. It's, again, philosophical, the extent to which something is...
But also, since it's more difficult, that may be the place where you really need to focus your attention.
A lot of people are.
There are some people who say that the origin of life really didn't occur here on Earth. It occurred...
It was Pan-Serbian, right?
Yeah, it occurred here in space. And life, or the biological molecules, were brought here in the early bombardment of the Earth, which was much more intense in the early history of Earth. And therefore, life was, once it got here, or once you got these prebiotic molecules here on Earth, then they could rapidly assemble and become what you see. The final outcome. Now, this is a singularity event, and that is one of the reasons why people are studying asteroids and comets.
Of course, one of the very serious speculations right now is that all life on Earth came from Mars. Mars was warm, wet, habitable, probably sometime before Earth. If life arises quickly, then it could be so life arose on Mars, you had an impact event, lifted Martian meteorites that came to Earth fairly easily through gravitational transfer, and then Earth becomes seeded by Mars before it starts itself. And there are plenty of people who are talking about, let's go to Mars and find the precursor of Earth life. So,
one question, how life originated in Mars?
Yeah, of course. It just defers, it just transfers the question to someplace else. So I mean, in that sense, that you still have to ask the origin question, but it is intriguing that now there are a lot of serious NASA scientists who are arguing that could happen.
You could also argue that life, that the synthesis really occurred in the interstellar medium, and the trigger for the self-replication point was a singular astronomical event in the interstellar medium, which irradiates, say, the dust particles, still keeps them under. Irradiate the dust particles in such a way that you make right-handed prebiotic material versus left-handed. So you would expect to find, if that is true, if we can ever find life someplace else, then you would expect to find, I think, both right and left-handed versions of life in other solar systems or other galaxies.
So did life stop 4.856 billion years ago, or 1 billion years ago?
Well, the oldest fossils are 3.5 or so. There seem to be, if you believe in certain kinds of, if you accept that certain kinds of isotopic signatures can point to life, there's isotopically light carbon at 3.8 in some rocks. But, I mean, who knows? I mean, the window could be 4.4. There are oceans. There are deep, wet environments very early.
I think of this as a biological system, because that's what I am. Basically, it looks as if life is monophyletic, but that's still a big surprise. Lots of things are monophyletic. If you look through the tree of life, huge groups that arose from one species back then, among the millions that might have existed, that's still a big deal.
And certainly many people have talked about multiple origins of life, you know, life arising a million times, but then it was a highly competitive environment, and eventually, if you do various computer models can give you different answers, but if you have one form of life that becomes sufficiently more efficient than everything else, it just eats everything else. So that's one possible explanation. So we don't know if there may be self-replicating cycles arising all the time and they're just immediately consumed by cells. We just don't know at this point. So it's I think that's one of the very exciting frontiers in kind of... It's going to be done. It's going to be done in the lab.
And on that note, let's thank Bob again. I want to thank all of you for coming to most of these seminars. I want to thank the class in particular. And of course, remind the class that they can ask Bob questions tomorrow morning at 8:30.